Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a cognitive neuropsychologist at Brock about the effects to the brain a simple bump to the head can cause. We hear from a political science professor about the impact of the first quarter century of the World Wide Web, especially in the world of politics. And we talk to a Brock dramatic arts instructor who is heavily involved in the organizing of the annual October Soiree fundraiser, as well as other artistic pursuits outside the university setting. Information from head to toe and everything in between, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. And we begin with information we're following up on a program earlier this year on Inquisitive Minds. We discussed concussions with Brent Fott, chair of the Department of Health Sciences at Brock. But what if that knock on the noggin doesn't seem all that bad initially? Should you still be concerned? According to Brock University cognitive neuropsychologist Don Good, indeed you should be. Mild injuries to the brain can alter your attention, your mood, your processing speed, and your arousal as compared to people who do not have a history of injury. Dawn and her team published research recently showing people who report mild head injury may be less able to psychologically assess, or respond to stressful situations. Dawn Good joined us in our CFPU studios recently as March's Brain Awareness Month drew to a close to talk about just how bad that bump on the head can actually be. I asked Professor Good first of all about her area of expertise, cognitive neuropsychology, and just how far that realm of study extends.
Basically, the relationship between brain and thought, brain and behavior, and in particular, cognition refers to, you know, sort of how we think, what we know, how we communicate, what we understand, how we pay attention. It's sort of those special functions that let us understand our world.
So what does your research embrace? Does it embrace both traumatic brain injury as well as a deterioration of the brain, something like Alzheimer's, for example?
Yes, I'm interested in all kinds of neurological compromise, particularly to the central nervous system. So that would be, you know, dementias and any kind of stroke. But primarily, you know, in terms of some of the core research we do, it's in traumatic brain injury.
Now, you work out of the Jack and Nora Walker Canadian Center for Lifespan Development Research at Brock,
yes,
where you have a number of observational testing rooms. So who gets tested? Do you have to be referred, or are you looking for people? And as far as the testing goes, how do you go about testing the individuals?
Mm-hmm. So our lab, we actually have a true lifespan perspective. So we work with children right up to very senior individuals, much older adults, and everything in between. So, and we also work across the spectrum from mild difficulties with neurological functions and normal neurological function to individuals with severe catastrophic injury to the brain or some kind of compromise to the brain. So we go right across from mild to severe and very young to very old. We work with university students. A lot of the individuals we have, they recruited from the university population directly, and a lot of students will participate out of interest, sometimes for course credit for the experience. And sometimes students will participate for some kind of remuneration. And we also recruit from the community, individuals that are experiencing the effects of brain injury and living with the effects of brain injury. Sometimes they will be identified for us through either a medical source or through the Ontario Brain Injury Association. And we work with them all.
Now, do impairments to the brain vary depending on the severity of the type of injury that might be inflicted on the brain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It depends on the extent of the injury, but also the site of injury. So certain areas of the brain are more flexible and will respond in much more variable ways than other parts of the brain. So some of the brain is really, really hardwired. If you want to, if you knock out the area that's important for swallowing, then you won't be able to swallow. You knock out the area for producing certain kinds of words, like in language, well, you still might be able to produce other words, right? So there's, because they'll recruit healthy tissue from around that can be more what we call plastic. And we talk about plasticity of the brain.
Yeah, because certain parts of the brain are devoted to certain functions. Yeah. It's almost like compartments, if you will.
Certainly, some parts of the brain are very dedicated to certain compartments and dedicated to a particular function. And then other parts of the brain, they're generically dedicated to function, but their specificity is a little more broad-based. It really allows for that experiential learning component, right? It's kind of like neurons waiting there for you to expose them to some experience.
Almost waiting for the order to do whatever you want them to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Depending on the severity of the injury, of course, how can it impact the person's daily functions, how they go about their daily lives?
Right. So if you think of the organs of the body, the brain's probably the most important organ, and it dictates and directs, orchestrates what the rest of the body does. A lot of what, you know, even just walking is going to come from the brain telling us the sequence of muscles and the force that those muscles need to be used and the angles and the proprioception that those muscles need to go through in order for you to be functioning and walking. It's important for thinking. It's important for reasoning. So it goes right across the gambit of all of various different kinds of human behavior. And depending on how much of the injury occurs, how much of the brain has been involved in been impacted by an injury of some sort, and where, that will dictate what kinds of challenges the individual will have. If it's a small area of the brain and it's in the area of the medial temporal lobe, then you might have some problems with word finding, or you might have some problems with memory, recalling things, recollecting, retrieving information. If it's a big area of the brain, a lot of tissues involved and a lot of area of the temporal lobe and the hippocampus and that general area, then you're going to have a frank amnesia, right? You don't recall, you don't know, you can't tell me what was going on in your life 5 minutes ago. So it is on a dimensional continuum, and that's what a lot of our research tries to concentrate on, is to look at what is that continuum? How minor is minor and how severe is severe? And can we look at gradations along that line as a function of keeping in mind also the site of the injury as well as the extent?
Now, I've talked to people before about concussions. We had quite a discussion earlier this season because, especially in contact sports, concussions are a serious problem. And I wonder, in every day-to-day life, any blow to the head can cause damage? Or where do we draw that line between, oh, it just hurts, but I'm not going to worry about it, and maybe this is something a little bit more and I should have it looked at?
That's the most excellent question, because I would suggest we don't have a line to draw, and that's what makes it really ambiguous. When do you go to the doctor? When is it serious? When does it go from minor and not going to impact my life to being more and more serious? And it's going to be dimensional. For the most part, if you experience an altered state of consciousness, you know, you bang your head, you get a really good kind of dizzy, bell ringing type of experience, you know, chances are, you know, sit down, sit on the bench, take a break, sit out. Certainly if it's a sports, contact sport, sit out the game, you know, give your brain some time, because there's an incredible metabolic cascade that your brain goes through immediately through any kind of knock to the head. But for the most part, recoverable. So that's the sort of the more traditional 7 to 10 day hold off and then become active again. But no injury is minor in that it's not necessarily going to result in some kind of perhaps more serious injury. So something that might seem like quite minor and you just have an altered state of consciousness, no loss of consciousness, sometimes there can be something more sinister. It could be a bleed in behind. Usually in that case, though, individuals would be having headaches. They'd be having more of the nausea. The symptoms would often correlate with the more maybe complicated head injury.
Yeah, I was going to ask about symptoms and if there's something after you have some kind of a blow to the head, if there's something that tips you off that, yeah, there's something more at play here than just, you know, this headache that I've been experiencing.
Yeah. So again, you look for persistence of symptoms, and sometimes you can miss it, but the research varies, but anywhere from 5 to 10% of the population who experiences a more minor, mild, bang to the head, will develop persistent symptoms that will go well beyond that 7 to 10 day sort of marker. And in fact, we find that it's 3 to 6 months of persistent symptoms is not uncommon and still is recoverable. And in fact, oftentimes, unless the symptoms maintain for over a year, we wouldn't really see it as something that's going to be more permanent in terms of the impact on the individual's life. And what's interesting about some of the research we do, there's still measurable differences right from the more gentle injuries to the head. So we will find differences in individuals that have banged their head. They've had a, you know, it has to be a, you know, a noticeable bang to the head, but it might not even be what some people might think of as a full-blown concussion, although the definition of that is really quite variable as well. But we can detect statistically differences right from that first altered state of consciousness, even a year and 2 years later. But the individual walking around in the world is saying, I'm fine, it's not interfering with my daily living, I don't feel I'm at risk. So they're okay, but there has been a change, and the change seems to be persistent, even if the symptoms aren't persistent. What that cautions is about, though, are the repeated concussions. What we find is that same individual now, if they experience another bang to the head, then the symptoms start generally to accumulate, right? And it almost exacerbates. So you get this vulnerability, particularly in situations where there are common repeated concussions, such as a contact sport, where you can get this incredible increase in their symptoms, their responsivity, and resulting in more permanent injuries. So that now when we look on it, say, a CT scan or an MRI scan, you'll actually see some permanent changes to the brain that may not recover depending on the severity of the contusions.
Yeah, so in other words, one concussion or bad knock to the head is bad enough, but the more you get, the cumulative effect
can be quite serious.
Right.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't ignore any of them.
Right.
But you have to give it a little bit of time to see what effects are at play here before you jump to conclusions as to what happened.
Absolutely.
I think for a lot of people, you know, when they think a hockey player being thrown into the boards and they get a concussion, or they're knocked to the ice and they get a concussion, I can see that. That's a big problem. But in everyday life, it's so easy to downplay the severity of a blow to the head from, I don't know, maybe you fall off a 6-foot ladder, for example, and bang your head.
Exactly.
You may not feel that's all that serious.
Yeah.
But it can be.
It can be.
And also the fact that you're not prepared for the fall, so you're not...
Brace yourself the same
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You absolutely can. And you got to remember, you know, even if there isn't always an external evidence to an injury, the internal injuries may exist. I mean, that's the caution, because the brain is very, very soft tissue. The cranium isn't, right? That's a solid surface that soft tissue is potentially being compressed against, and perhaps with quite significant force, depending on what the fall is.
So if a brain suffers trauma, we touched on this briefly earlier, what happens? What process happens in the brain that causes injury? In other words, when you get that blow, which is sort of like in a shell, a hard shell, it's encased in this hard shell known as your skull, what happens to the brain?
Yeah, there's a few things that can happen. Okay, first of all, you have the soft brain being moved. So it's a soft tissue that's moving around. Well, it's tied to a spinal cord. It's tied to your cranial nerve. So if you're moving a organ, you're stretching the neurons that it's otherwise connected to. And that stretching effect, it can harm the tissue, the membranes around the neurons. So you can get small bleeds, tiny little bleeds. And we call that diffuse axonal injury, where it's just these stretching effects that can just mess up how the neuron actually does what it needs to do in terms of moving things from the nucleus down to its collateral terminal buttons. So sometimes it can be just interruption. So there's biochemical changes that can occur. There's also very structural things that can occur. When that brain moves, it can bang into the hard outer shell, and that causes bleeding, or could cause bleeding. It certainly can cause swelling. If you have swelling inside a container, where's it going to go? Right? And the swelling in the brain not only occurs on the outside surface of the brain, but we have ventricles in the middle of the brain that are there for to manage compression as well, or one of the things that they can do is manage compression. But if they start to swell, they push the brain tissue to the outside of the skull, and the outside of the skull is not going to give. So those can be problems that are secondary to the actual impact injury. The extent of the bleeding, the interruption of, if you get a hole in the head, if you actually kill off a nucleus, the neuron could die, and then that neuron can no longer be connected to other neurons. So you can have disruption or disconnection of one area of the brain to another area of the brain. It's not there anymore. Neuron's not available to you anymore. So it really, again, depends on the severity of the injury and, in fact, the etiology. So, I mean, stroke can cause neural damage as well, but you might not get the rotational force problem. So it varies on how you got the injury and the extent of it.
Given this conversation, what I'm taking out of this is the brain, not so much is more fragile, but more susceptible than we realize.
Yeah. And I like to talk about the brain as being having its vulnerabilities and its resiliencies. I mean,
sure.
It's not fragile. It's really quite a well-comprised organ, and it's got some opportunity for plasticity. So it can have variability and you know, you can recruit other areas of the brain to help you accomplish a task. It's got incredible resilience, but the problem is it's also really, really important. And if you harm it, there's likely a consequence.
Is there something that happens in your life when you suffer a brain injury of some sort or debilitation of the brain? Does it affect how you handle things day to day, for example, stress?
Absolutely, it can. And in fact, that's one of the areas that's particularly vulnerable, in the fact that stress is really a preparedness response. So it's when we kind of really hype up the system. And you hype up the system, one of the ways you and I are aware of that we're hyping up the system is through activation of our sympathetic nervous system, which is, you know, increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate, increased muscle tension, all of the things that really let your body get ready for, I got to do something, good or bad stress, right? We've got to hype ourselves up. Getting ready for a really important hockey game, you want to get stressed up. You want to get hyped up. Getting ready for an interview, you need to kind of get stressed up, hyped up. But sometimes the stresses are really bad as well, right? So then that's when we usually use the term stressed out. But either way, it's that sort of getting the whole body up and at 'em. When there's been an interruption to the brain, and this is almost any kind of etiology to the brain, there are a couple things that are just sort of common consequences of the brain being altered. And slowed processing is one of them. And lower arousal, lower capacity for arousal is another. So we have referred to under arousal. Well, if you're under aroused, physiologically starting at a lower status than you might otherwise be, then how do you hype up, right? You don't hype up as readily. It's more what we call dysregulated. And that dysregulation can affect your emotions, which we often associate with stress, but also just your cognitive performance, because we need to hype up the system to be optimum in our performance. We know there's a relationship between our arousal levels and our test performance, for example, how well we think, how clearly, how alert we are, how clearly we think, and how competent we can be. Stress too much, competence will go down. You don't stress enough, competence doesn't reach its optimal levels. Then if you've interrupted the brain, you've interfered with that relationship, right? You're starting at an even lower level, so it takes more to get to your optimal performance, and you will not handle stress, but you won't even handle cognitive situations as effectively or efficiently as you would have otherwise.
So bottom line, blow to the head, have it looked at if you're experiencing symptoms afterwards. Don't ignore it.
Absolutely.
How was the stress level during the conversation this morning?
Yeah, it was there. I don't know if I reached optimal levels or not. Maybe superseded.
Professor Good, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was Brock University cognitive neuropsychologist Don Good with a look at research showing the effects a mild head injury can have on our brain. This year, something we pretty much take for granted turns 25. In that quarter century, we have developed a sort of love-hate relationship with WWW. Yes, the so-called World Wide Web has literally changed our lives in the last 25 years, and not entirely for the better, some would say. But is it all bad, all good, or a combination of the two? It depends on who you talk to, I suppose. So let's talk about the impact of the World Wide Web on our lives for the next few minutes here on Inquisitive Minds. Brock University Professor of Political Science Blaine Hegart, the author of an upcoming book, Copy Fight, the global politics of digital copyright reform, joined us in our CFPU studios recently to discuss the Internet, the World Wide Web, and where we go from here. I asked Professor Haggard, first of all, about his earliest recollections of the World Wide Web.
It would have to be back when I was an undergrad at Carleton University back in the early 1990s. And I was working at the this is the first thing that comes to my mind. I was working at the student newspaper there, and we were all of a sudden starting to use this thing called, again, called the World Wide Web, but it was essentially text-based browsers, and everything was in text. And it was just absolutely remarkable. We had you could go from one place to the other in the world, getting information and making it so much easier to find out stuff than it was before. And it was all in text. There were no pictures. I remember at one point when it became more common when people started putting images and stuff online, I remember thinking, well, why would anyone want to do that? I mean, we've got everything we need right now with all this text. We don't need to clutter it up with pictures or anything like this. And so things have changed since then.
More than a little. Do you think when the Internet was born 25 years ago, anyone had any idea just how it would change our lives?
When the World Wide Web was born?
Yeah.
Because the first thing to point out, too, is, of course, that this, right now it's not the 25th anniversary of the Internet. It's the 25th anniversary of the World Wide Web, which is essentially, it's kind of a service that runs on the Internet at large, like email itself. It's another service. Yeah, it's the invention of the World Wide Web really has revolutionized and popularized the use of the Internet to connect people, to share information. You could make an argument that it is probably one of the most revolutionary technologies since the invention of movable type.
Now, the World Wide Web, as you say, is one aspect of the Internet. The Internet was originally designed for what? What was the first purpose?
It was a U.S. Defense Department project in order to try to make sure that communications could continue in the event of a nuclear attack by the Soviet Union on the United States. The idea being that if one part of the U.S. or one part of the U.S. communications infrastructure is knocked out, then the remaining communications infrastructure could reroute around this damage and keep the rest of what's left of the United States in the event of a nuclear attack intact, and so they'd be able to continue talking to each other. So that was the original goal. And after that, of course, scientists ran with it, and so it was used as an exchange, as a means of exchanging information among scientists and academics at various universities.
So today, you can't escape the Internet.
No.
You can't escape the World Wide Web.
No. And it's more than that.
Is that a good thing, though?
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is we can't even imagine a world without the World Wide Web.
Well, certainly people who are in university now, for example, couldn't possibly fathom not having the Internet around.
Yeah.
So is that a good or a bad thing?
I think that it is one of the best. It's like I said, I compared it to the invention of movable type, which led to the world that we have today. And I think that the World Wide Web, we can make similar and I think mostly positive claims for that as well. I think it's definitely been a force for good in the world.
As a professor of political science, I'm sure you've seen a drastic shift in the political process due to the Internet. You can't escape that.
Yeah. And one of the things that I study is online social movements and how communications technologies, not just the web, but email and web-based services like Facebook, have made it easier for citizens and activists to get together and engage with political leaders, and also for political leaders to reach out to constituents. So it's brought previously isolated groups. It's allowed them to communicate in ways that they weren't able to before, and possibly counter other more easily established groups.
Yeah, it's much easier to be in touch with the grassroots level of your political support with the advent of the internet. But it also gives those people at the grassroots level much more of a voice than they would have had much, much longer ago.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's, you know, we shouldn't say that the internet is a panacea and has delivered us to this kind of democratic utopia. But at the same time, too, I think that you're absolutely right. In one of the things that I study, which is social movements around copyright politics, which is, you know, deeply in, you know, intertwined with the rise of the World Wide Web, the public interest previously wasn't really represented in these in the making of copyright policy. It used to be large institutional interests like the music industry, libraries, artists group. The group really left out of it was the individual who both uses and consumes these works and also then takes these works and uses them to make other works, be it books or music or whatever. And this public interest, which is basically isolated individuals, they really didn't have a way to kind of aggregate before. What we've seen around the world is individuals coming together in this area and others to put forward a view that essentially they didn't know that other – maybe they knew that other people had it, but they had no way of coordinating and working together before the web, before internet-enabled technologies.
So let's talk about social media, which, of course, is a part of the internet.
Yeah.
And again, you can't escape it now. Has it been most effective in getting the political messages out to the grassroots much more so than in the past?
Has it been most effective
or more effective than other ways?
What it's done is it's made it easier. So you still have to get people either contacting their elected representatives or, you know, marching in the streets, having protests. And so you still have leaders and social movements and things like that. But what now, it's easier. The costs of reaching potentially interested in, individuals or citizens has been drastically reduced by things like email or by things like Facebook. It used to be that, you know, you'd have to send out mailers or anything or, you know, contact people that way and you'd get a low response rate. Now email's, you know, a lot cheaper to do, and because of social media, which, you know, you can post something online and if it gets picked up, other people will do essentially the grunt work for you of communicating to other people. So it does make it a lot easier for people, if they want to at least to get their voices heard and to contact, you know, and to start up these groups.
But it also makes it easier for those who don't like your political point of view to put up an effective defense against it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, which is, you know, it should be a good thing. I mean, one of the nice things about where some of these politics is going is that it's going to be harder to do what is called astroturfing, which is essentially trying to put up a group and claiming that you have representatives. It's not just you can't just use social media to, you know, promote your view. In this kind of new politics, you also have to get people to support, to, you know, to get on board with it. And if you can't get that, you can have all the flashy websites you want and all the Twitter accounts that you want. But if you can't get people to agree with you and to essentially, you know, carry some water for you, then you're in trouble.
So would you say that social media especially would level the playing field? Because it gives everyone sort of like an equal voice in airing their opinions, especially in the political arena, because one person who has maybe more money than another person doesn't necessarily have an advantage. We all have access to social media.
We do, but at the same time, too, resources and money still counts for stuff, because you're right. You can have, you know, with just one person can set up a website or something, and maybe that'll catch on, but it takes a lot of time and energy to run these things. So, you know, if you can't do something, if you can't like stay on top of an issue full time, it might, you know, you might be able to pursue it for a little bit, but at the end of the day, maybe you'll have to go off and do something else, and then who will take over for you? And so then the hope is that someone else will pick up the torch, but not necessarily so. Whereas if you have a lot of money, you can pay people to kind of keep propagating the message. And so the big challenge for social media-led campaigns is making sure that the movement that these things start can continue in the long term after the kind of like the initial burst has faded, because deep entrenched interests with lots of money in deep pockets, they can stay there and they've got staying power. Social media, it allows you to get your voice out, but you've still got to maintain the voice. So resources still do matter a lot in this brave new world.
Well, the brave new world of the internet is viewed by most as this vast open space
mm-hmm.
that's free to everyone.
Yes.
It's the new frontier, if mm-hmm. you will. Is it realistic to expect that that will continue, or where do you think the internet's going to go in the future?
I think it's a mistake even to think that it is, to think of it in terms of a vast, wide frontier. My partner actually is completing some work down at the Australian National University on a PhD, and she's looking at online enforcement of trademarks. So how are brands protected online, similar to the stuff that's going on with copyright. And what she finds is that and I feel a bit bad about previewing her research, but what she finds is that essentially that there are various choke points on the internet that you can use that that if you control these things, then it makes it harder to express yourself online. For instance, internet access, individuals' access, the ability to access the internet. That's one thing. Search engines is another thing. And the other thing would be payment providers. If you can control those three things, then you can control a lot of what happens on the internet. The other thing, too, to remember is that the internet is a regulated space. There are laws in cyberspace, and they're the laws written in the statutes of Canada, the United States, of whatever country you want.
If there were a kryptonite for the internet, what do you think it would be?
A kryptonite? Do you mean something that could...
A real weakness?
I think the biggest weakness right now for the internet itself, the internet is the way it is because of the way it was designed. So as the American academic Lawrence Lessig says, code is law. So the rules in the computer programs that make up the internet and make up the World Wide Web, they allow for openness and they allow for kind of the ability to root around disruptions because that's the way it's designed. Change the code of the internet and you change the internet itself. So I think that the biggest challenge right now for the internet is being posed by the actions of the National Security Agency in the United States and the U.S. government and Canadian government, and essentially governments all around the world, who, it turns out, have been monitoring all of our communications all the time, and including, we've just learned this past week, not only metadata, which is bad enough, but also logging voice calls of an entire country. So this is, I think, quite rightly causing non-American countries, in the case of the NSA revelations, to freak out and think about, okay, well, we're going to have to put up essentially firewalls around our country, and we've got to regulate exactly how the traffic moves on the internet. And, of course, what this does is it sets up a situation where the thing about the internet is that it connects everything in it and passes around borders. That's the strength of it. If you change those laws to make it so that you've got like a Brazilian internet, a U.S. internet, a Canadian internet, almost what's the point? And it could possibly cause some real damage to the web as we're used to it today.
The internet is the internet is the internet. It can't be a certain country's internet. It has to be everyone's internet.
Well, it can. But that's the thing, is it can be. But you change the rules of the internet, it'll become something else. Mm-hmm. But it'll still be there. The other big challenge too is has to do with something that I study, which is the enforcement of copyright online or of intellectual property online. I think we're all familiar with things like Napster and downloading, and how the music and motion picture publishing industries are very upset that people are violating their copyrights online, and it's so easy to copy and then distribute anything that can be digitized. The real problem, though, is that in order to fully enforce intellectual property and copyright online requires almost constant monitoring of people's communications to decide what's an authorized communication and what's not. And that raises a lot of problems to do with privacy and also freedom of expression. And also who decides exactly, you know, where to draw the line between an authorized download and an unauthorized one.
Now, this is all going to be covered in your forthcoming book, which is out any moment now.
Any moment, we're told. Yes.
It's called Copy Fight, The Global Politics of Digital Copyright Reform.
Yes.
So specifically, you're dealing with the snafu that is copywriting in the digital age. Because
yes.
When copyrights were introduced, it was an entirely different ballgame.
That's right, yeah. The copying has always happened. It's kind of what we do as humans. But the copyright largely comes out in a different era where things were copied physically. Copying was a labor-intensive process, and what the laws were largely set up to do was to take care of commercial copyright entities like publishing, like, I don't know, rogue publishing houses or whatever. What's changed, of course, with the internet and digital technologies is now everyone with access to a computer and an internet connection can copy and distribute anything that, like I said, anything that can be digitized at a fraction of the cost that it used to take. It used to take multi-million dollar companies to do this. Now it doesn't. And so this has posed an existential crisis for the existing copyright-based industries.
Canada's copyright laws, are they able to keep up with the digital age?
We've just embarked on a couple years now, a decade-long process of trying to adapt our copyright laws. The question is, do they do what... First of all, what do we want copyright laws to do, and then do they do that? And of course, as you can imagine, there's lots of different opinions on exactly whether or not they've hit the balance. Canada's copyright laws are actually there's some important problems with them, but in a lot of ways, there's some kind of world leading exceptions. To try to deal with the internet age, like the non-commercial use of digital mashups of copyrighted works done for non-commercial use, things like that.
And this will all be covered in your book.
The book essentially what it asks is who is responsible. Right now, who makes copyright law? What potential do individual citizens and also smaller countries have to put out a copyright law that responds to what they want and what they need. Because the big issue in global copyright is that the conversation has, for the past 30 or so years, has tended to be pushed by the United States and in particular by its copyright industries, Hollywood, the record industry, and so on. They have a very specific interest in stronger copyrights because they happen to own the majority of economically valuable copyrights. But stronger copyright isn't necessarily in the best interest of other groups or other countries because, and I think this is something that gets lost when we talk about copyright, is it's not designed as a private right for creators to get paid. That's sort of part of it. But what it's designed for, it's a law that tries to take the big picture. It's supposed to encourage both the production of creative works and the dissemination as well. So there's a balancing act that has to be played there, and it has to encourage both. And so we tend, I think, often to focus just on like the enforcement of copyright laws, but we also have to ask ourselves when we're evaluating, like say the Canadian copyright law, does it encourage both production and dissemination?
So the book is called...
Copy Fight.
Copy Fight, The Global Politics of Digital Copyright Reform, out very soon. The author of the book is a professor of political science at Brock University, Blaine Hygert, and we thank you very much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
That was Blaine Hygert, professor of political science at Brock, looking back at the first 25 years of the World Wide Web and how it has transformed many things, including how it has revolutionized politics. His new book, he tells me, will be out shortly. This is Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. I'm your host, Mike Saunders. Being a fan of live theater myself, I take more than a passing interest in the Department of Dramatic Arts at Brock and all of the related activities having to do with the arts in the classroom as well as on local stages around Niagara. In February, for example, I attended the colloquium on the changing face of theater criticism in the digital age up at Brock. One of the panelists at one of the Friday sessions was Monica Dufault, a part-time instructor at Brock, as well as the director of the university's annual Gala Fundraiser, or Gala Fundraiser, if you will, Brock's October Soiree. This year as well, Monica has assumed the co-artistic director's position at one of our local theater companies, Essential Collective Theater, in downtown St. Catharines. Monica joined us in our CFPU-FM studios recently to talk about her life at Brock and beyond those hallowed halls up on the escarpment. When I asked her first about what brought her to Brock in the first place.
Well, that's a good question. I was looking for some part-time work as an actor and freelance director. I needed to fill in those gaps. So I happened to call Jillian Raby at Brock University and asked if I could possibly work as a part-time instructor or a teaching assistant with their Department of Dramatic Arts. And that was my first in. I was a teaching assistant with David Fancy on the first year performance course. And then after that, I kind of developed into an instructor myself, and that's what I'm doing now.
Now, have you done any studies at Brock yourself?
Actually, I have. In 2010, I did an MA in Comparative Literature and Arts.
Okay, yeah, I noticed that you were part of the SCLA class of 2011.
That's right, I graduated in 2011.
Yeah, the Studies in Comparative Literature and Arts. So what area are you concentrating your studies on?
In that program, I concentrated on theater, actually, and my thesis was an examination of a one-woman show that I performed called That Woman, a Sex Play, which was written by David Fancy and was performed in the spring of 2011.
At Brock?
Actually, it was performed at the Courthouse Theater.
Oh, okay, downtown.
Yeah, but it was part of the Industrial Fabric series that the Maryland I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts puts together every year.
Which is on right now and continues till the end of April.
That's right, yeah.
I had a conversation about that just a couple of weeks ago on the program. It's an exciting idea. But as I mentioned to Derek Knight when he was in on the program, I have no idea how people find the time because, I mean, it's March and April. It's the end of the semester for Brock.
Mm-hmm.
How do people find the time to get involved in all this?
Well, I think for a lot of students, certainly in the Department of Dramatic Arts, these are culminating activities for their coursework. So they have no choice but to be involved, right? The director's projects. Of course, the student performers in those are volunteers, but the directing students themselves, this is their final outcome for their course. I was surprised to see, in fact, not just this year, but in past years when I've attended the One Act Festival, how many people are there. And you have to reserve tickets because the studios are very small, so they're sold out. It's wonderful. And not just students, but community audience members as well.
Now, you mentioned you're a part-time instructor at Brock now.
That's right, yeah.
So you're teaching dramatic arts.
I'm teaching first-year performance, yeah.
You're also directing the university's annual gala or gala.
Yes.
Depending on which side of the fence you're on.
Right.
The October Soiree.
Yes, Brock's October Soiree. I've directed that for 4 years now, I believe, and this will be my fifth in October.
So it's like doing the Academy Awards every year. You just, well, it was a success this year. Let's bring her back next year and do it again.
Well, I hope that's the sentiment behind it. But, you know, the event is growing each year and an interesting opportunity for students at the university, but also we often have alumni coming to perform at that event. And we've also been hiring some professional performers. So it's an interesting mixture of talent that ends up being featured in the event itself.
Mm-hmm. Does it become sort of like an unwieldy vehicle every year? Because all the planning that goes into this, mm-hmm. I mean, we see the end product.
Right, yeah.
We don't see the work that goes into it. Does it become this huge vehicle that you've got to maneuver around trying to get everything done?
Well, it is a huge vehicle. I will certainly give you that. I mean, I think they have approximately 300 guests each year. As far as performers, I would estimate 60 student performers from the Department of Dramatic Arts and the Music Department combined. And then we also have some alumni coming back to perform, as well as professional performers like Guy Bannerman, who has been hired to play Brock each year, and he's incredibly entertaining. So preparations have started already for this year's soiree. In fact, I think I started about a month after the other one finished. So November of 2013, I was already planning the 2014 event. And because it is the 50th anniversary of the university, we're celebrating that in the soiree planning and in what we're hoping to do with the programming for that evening. So, yes, it is a lot of planning. And I think this is going to be probably, I can safely say, the biggest one yet, the most elaborate.
Yeah, I was going to ask about when you start planning, because I always hear about, well, a month after or even a week after one event, we start planning the next. And I think to myself, do they really do that? Or do they just say that and then they start thinking about it and then they start acting on it? When you start physically moving towards the next production, that's within a month of the previous one?
Well, I don't think that's been the case in the past, but because we knew that this was going to be a slightly bigger celebration because of the 50 years of Brock, we wanted to incorporate perspectives from a lot of people. So a lot of my early work was actually consulting with department chairs of music and visual arts and dramatic arts and STACK, just to get their perspectives on what we wanted to celebrate, how we wanted this piece to take shape. And then, of course, there's the planning committee of the soiree itself and the president's office that coordinates all of this. So there are a lot of players that have to be brought into the story and into the vision of the evening.
So you're basically putting the wheels in motion.
Oh, yes.
Almost immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
You're also active in the local theater scene, too, and you've taken over recently as co-artistic director. Are you still co-artistic director, or are you the artistic director for Essential Collective Theater?
Currently, I'm the co-artistic director of Essential Collective Theater with Stephanie Jones. I was appointed to that position January 1st of 2014. And as of July 1st, 2014, I will be the sole artistic director of the company. Stephanie is retiring from that position. And Jason Cadieux, who has been her artistic partner for many years as artistic producer of ECT, is also retiring. So I'll be taking on both roles, really. And I'm now putting together the 2014-2015 season for the company. I'm very excited about that. But, of course, the 2013-2014 season isn't quite finished, so we have a show opening on April 2nd, Scenic View, at the Courthouse Theater, and it runs till April 6th. And then we have some other events coming up in the spring, including a new collaboration with the Niagara Literary Arts Festival. We're doing a playwright weekend, June 6th and 7th, and we're really going to be celebrating playwriting, local playwriting, as well as bringing in TJ Daw, who is a performer who is very well known on the Fringe circuit, and he's going to be performing his show, Medicine, that weekend on the 7th. And then Essential Collective Theater has been assisting playwrights in the region for, this will be our ninth year of an annual play development program that culminates in our wine and reading event. And that will be on May 15th at Henry of Pelham Winery. So lots of things still happening this year. And I'm, of course, looking forward to next year and programming that season.
I talked to Stephanie Jones just last week, as a matter of fact, the fact that she and Jason are retiring from ECT. And she said, it's almost like a mother giving up her baby.
I think that's true.
Which didn't surprise me in a way. So this is an emotional attachment you develop with not so much your job, but what turns out to be a labor of love, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a calling, really. I mean, if we look at what Stephanie and Jason together have managed to accomplish with their company, Essential Collective Theater, over the last 15 years, really, that they've been producing original theater in St. Catharines, it's remarkable. They have, as I was was talking about established an annual play development program for regional playwrights. They have produced contemporary Canadian work here in St. Catharines. They've developed an audience for that work. And of course, it feels, I can only imagine it feels like that they've created a baby here, and it will be difficult to let go of it, I'm thinking. But I will say that Stephanie and Jason will be serving on our advisory board, so they still have a connection with the company, and I'm hoping that they will still perform with the company and do other activities related to ECT.
And the final show of this season, which you say opens April the 2nd, features the two of them in scenic view at the Sullivan Mahoney Theater, the Courthouse Theater in downtown St. Catharines.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a piece that Stephanie and Jason wrote about 15 years ago when they first started working together and when they first came together as a couple. So they wrote this, and now they've adapted it. They've updated this piece, and it's really about two writers who are writing about two actors who are performing two characters from another play. And the piece is a romantic comedy. It's really delightful, and it's also, it's Stephanie and Jason's love letter to the theater and to St. Catharines.
So, and a bit of a swan song, too.
And a bit of a swan song, absolutely, yeah.
How important is it for someone like yourself, an instructor in the arts at Brock Dramatic Arts, to also get your hands dirty, if you will? You're out there in the community. You're not just instructing in the dramatic arts. Mm. You're a part of it yourself. How much do you need to get involved yourself so that you've got both sides covered?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're instructing others,
yeah,
but you're also taking the knowledge you've acquired over the years and applying it yourself.
Absolutely. I think it's really important. You know, theater is an experiential art form, right? We are the instruments, the actors who are performing on stage. And so I feel like I have to have outside experiences from the work that I do at the university. And that allows me to bring back energy to my teaching, allows me to bring back perspective to my teaching. And, you know, to also be able to connect what we're doing, the theory of performance, connect it to a practical experience. And then I can refer that my students to those practical experiences, right? I can share my own journeys through those pieces that I do outside of the university with my students. I think that, you know, we talked briefly about my work with David Fancy on That Woman, a Sex Play. And that piece was transformational for myself as a performer, but also allowed me to bring my experiences back to the classroom and be able to talk about what I was able to achieve with that piece or not achieve, what I felt I wasn't able to reach. So I think it's vital.
And those other perspectives give you another look at a particular piece, like you said.
Yes.
That you may not see yourself.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, another project that I just want to briefly mention, I've done some work with Mainstream Services here in Niagara, and this is an organization that supports adults with developmental disabilities. So last year, I wrote and directed a piece with a group of people from Mainstream that was designed for touring to elementary schools, and it's an anti-bullying play that they perform with puppets. I had a lot of students who were involved as volunteer actors who voiced the puppets for these performers. And I think that there was an opportunity there to see how the work of an actor can be connected to the community beyond being on the stage of the Shaw Festival or being on the stage of the Sullivan Mahoney Courthouse Theater. There are also ways that theater can affect lives in the community and create communication within the community. And I thought that was a really valuable project, and I was really pleased to be able to bring some students into work on that.
And they do great work.
Mm-hmm,
and just shows what you can do beyond the footlights.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask about what life is like for you beyond the theater, but I think you've just answered that question. There is no life beyond the theater. You just apply to other aspects of your life.
You know, that's true. I think that my work as an actor and director and playwright has kind of extended beyond just my work at the university and my work at the Essential Collective Theater. It permeates every moment of my life. Is that good? I hope so.
I'd say it is, yeah. Monica, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
It's
fascinating to meet you and talk about theater.
Thank you so much.
And there we heard from Monica Dufault, a part-time instructor in dramatic arts at Brock, who also directs the annual October Soiree fundraiser up at the university and is presently also co-artistic director of Essential Collective Theater in downtown St. Catharines. The art installation Monica was referring to is Vested Interest, created by Brain Farm, and is on display in ECT's FlexSpace studio at the downtown Courthouse Theater. You can contact ECT for more information on both the show and the art installation. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Next week, a repeat edition of the program. I'll be off on assignment, but we'll return the week after with another fresh edition of Inquisitive Minds. Until then, always remember to have an inquisitive mind.